classes.
I just love seeing people get their life back.
Clients Leah Littlefon Whiteplume and Anthony Big Medicine say Smith and the reentry program have been a lifeline.
Some of the challenges that I faced was like trying to get a job. I didn't have any clothes or shoes when I first got out, because what I had was the clothes on my back and that was it.
She helped me get my driver's license, something I never thought I'd actually do. She always there when I need it. She told me from when I first started working with her, she told me, she said, I'll help you. We also put in the effort too. You work super hard, she'll do her best, whatever she can for you.
The program's voluntary and open to tribal citizens enrolled in one of the two tribes of the Wind River Reservation, the Northern Arapaho and Eastern Shoshone. It's also open to tribal descendants who are not enrolled in either tribe and other Native American tribal members. Many in the program say they have faced ups and downs, but are more determined now to stay out of the justice system with the program's assistance, like clients Thunder Little Thunder and Dolan Nido.
I know that I could do this with the help of Terry's program's amazing. What she does is inspiring. I love her support, how she advocates for us and helps us with the right resources and gets us going on our feet.
When I got out of prison, I was trying to do it all myself, and I realized how hard that was. I think for somebody that's actually getting out of prison and trying to get back on their feet and trying to do the right thing and not just go back into the criminal mentality that they were in, I feel that this program is very helpful.
Substance misuse is among struggles clients say they have faced, which often led to crimes they were sent to prison for. The tribal reentry program requires sobriety, says Smith.
I'm very loud and proud about my recovery, and I had a really public downfall. So I feel like it's my responsibility to show people that we can get better.
And that's the choice clients like Serena Perea have made.
I have three children. Their father passed away in 2020 from alcoholism. Pretty much all they have left. Obviously, I've made some mistakes, and I just want to show them that I've learned from them so that in their future, they can take what I have and make something better for their children and generations to come.
I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, August 28, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes
Hannah Francis,
Josh Salem, and Isabel Charlet. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One.
The interim director of Evening News is Hannah Francis.
A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth, up next.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories.
Russia undermines security guarantees for Ukraine. Human rights in Palestine, a harsh reality ignored by the U.S. and Israel. And Ecuador's unique environmental protections are under assault. Russia undermined security guarantees for Ukraine. It didn't take long for the Trump-inspired plan for a Ukraine-Russia peace to unravel. All Moscow had to hear is talk about security guarantees for Ukraine, which the Russians strongly oppose. They not simply reject Ukraine's membership in NATO, they also reject European troops being deployed to Ukraine. And they insist on Russian participation in Ukraine's security, an obvious deal-breaker. Yet Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said, quote, "Seriously discussing issues of ensuring security without the Russian Federation is a utopia, a road to nowhere." So much for Trump's claim that Putin had, quote, "agreed that Russia would accept security guarantees for Ukraine," calling it a very significant step. Yes, it would be, except that the Trump team has consistently underestimated the scope of Russia's ambitions in this war. Russia wants to keep Ukraine subservient and outside the Western orbit. It can't possibly accept real security measures, which would have to include troops in Ukraine. Russia's immovable policy poses major problems for Europe's coalition of the willing, the group that backs President Zelensky's refusal to cede territory without a firm agreement on protecting Ukraine. That coalition, however, has apparently only agreed on the rough size of a force to be deployed inside Ukraine, about 15,000 troops, and has yet to deal with where the troops will come from and how they will be supplied. Then there's Trump, who has ruled out deploying U.S. forces in Ukraine, but has not ruled in any other kind of commitment to Ukraine's defense. Without such a commitment, the notion of his special envoy, Steve Witkoff, that Russia will accept a NATO-like defense of Ukraine has no meaning. All these obstacles to providing security for Ukraine are in addition to the lack of a ceasefire and strong signals from Moscow that a meeting between Putin and Zelensky will not happen anytime soon. Russia's preference is war over peace. Yet Trump says he wants to take 2 weeks to determine whether Russia or Ukraine is obstructing peace talks. Next, human rights in Palestine, a harsh reality ignored by the U.S. and Israel. In keeping with its low regard for human rights, the Trump administration's State Department has issued a truncated report on human rights in Israel. About 90% shorter than the previous edition, Nick Tulsey writes for The Intercept. This year's report, which is required by Congress, might as well not have been issued, given its disregard for reality. Josh Paul, who spent more than 11 years as the Director of Congressional and Public Affairs at the State Department, says, quote, "The first human rights report of Secretary Rubio's tenure can be summarized in just a few more words than it appears to be written in. Few truths, many half-truths, and nothing like the truths. Its coverage of Israel, the West Bank, and Gaza appears to have been written by someone who has been blindfolded, earmuffed, had a sock stuffed in their mouth, and then censored. Instead of focusing on the lawlessness of the Netanyahu government, including the charge of genocide that it faces in the International Court of Justice, the report spends most time on Hamas's crimes. On the ground, Palestinian rights are being trampled on in the West Bank, where Israel has approved a controversial tract of land for settlement in about 3,400 housing units. The tract is controversial because it essentially bisects the West Bank, making the prospect of a Palestinian state all the more unlikely. If implemented, says the British Foreign Secretary David Lammy, it would divide a Palestinian state in two, mark a flagrant breach of international law, and critically undermine the two-state solution. The Israeli government, he goes on, must reverse this decision. But of course it won't. Bezalel Smotrich, the far-right foreign finance minister, who is in charge of West Bank settlements, declared the project's approval was another step toward ensuring that the idea of a Palestinian state, quote, is being erased from the table. Every town, every neighborhood, every housing unit is another nail in the coffin of this dangerous idea, he said. The U.S., which in past years had protested settlement expansion, now stands aside. Mike Huckabee, the U.S. ambassador to Israel, said, quote, "Whether or not there should be a massive development in this project is a decision for the government of Israel to make, and so we would not try to evaluate the good or the bad of that," unquote. Israel's deprivation of human rights in Gaza has been amplified by a report from international experts that officially calls the Gaza City area in a state of famine. The Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, which is composed of experts in food insecurity, says that at least 500,000 people suffer from starvation, acute malnutrition, and death. Another 2 million residents of the Gaza Strip are not much better off. They are said to be experiencing severe hunger. The experts urge massive food aid shipments into Gaza immediately. The Netanyahu government calls the experts' report, quote-unquote, an outright lie. He continues on his course of rejecting a partial ceasefire and release of half the hostages, a plan Hamas has accepted. Simply put, Netanyahu wants total military victory, not a political agreement. Next, Ecuador's unique environmental protections are under assault. A new right-wing populist government in Ecuador is systematically dismantling environmental protections that has established the country as among the most forward-looking. Back in 2021, a constitutional court had issued a landmark ruling that protected a unique cloud forest called Los Cedros from copper and gold mining, using the unprecedented argument that Los Cedros had standing as a legal person with accompanying rights. But now an ambitious president, Daniel Noboa, who represents agribusiness interests, is riding roughshod over environmental protection. Two writers report that Noboa's policies, quote, will throw Ecuador's stunning landscapes open to mining and drilling, dismantle government agencies in the name of efficiency, target public officials and civic organizations that he claims obstruct his agenda, and concentrate broad emergency powers in his own hands, unquote. The Ministry of Environment, Water and Ecological Transition, for example, has been folded into the Ministry of Energy and Mines, and a so-called Foundations Law aims to protect any attempt by civil society groups, such as environmental activists, from challenging state power. The government is undermining legal challenges to these moves by threatening judges with impeachment. The outcome of this story is important because of the principle of rights of nature, which has been successfully applied to protecting unique environmental sites in New Zealand and Spain, and is being relied upon in court filings right here in Oregon. In other news, South Korea's new president follows Kim Dae-jung's foreign policy positions. In a speech commemorating Korea's liberation from Japanese rule, the new president, Lee Jae-myung, took a conciliatory line with North Korea, very much in the spirit of the so-called sunshine policy of Kim Dae-jung years ago. He said, quote, "We affirm our respect for the North's current system, aver that we will not pursue any form of unification by absorption, and assert that we have no intention of engaging in hostile acts," unquote. This positive statement contrasts with the acerbic stance taken by Kim Jong-un's powerful sister, Kim Yo-jong, who has dismissed any notion of North-South reconciliation as a, quote, "delusion." Now, says President Lee, is the time to move beyond outmoded Cold War mentalities and confrontation and usher in a new era of peace on the Korean Peninsula. Everybody knows that the long, drawn-out hostility benefits people in neither of the two Koreas. Lee has taken other small steps toward the North, halting propaganda broadcasts and removing loudspeakers along the inter-Korean border, urging civic groups to stop launching anti-North Korean leaflets, scaling down joint South Korea-U.S. military drills, and having his National Intelligence Service halt its decades-long propaganda radio broadcasts. Also in line with Kim Dae-jung's foreign policy of years ago, President Lee proposed a forward-looking relationship with Japan. Quote, "It is time to squarely face the past while also wisely stepping forward into the future," he said. "Guided by the principle of pragmatic, national interest-focused diplomacy, we will seek forward-looking, mutually beneficial cooperation with Japan while holding frequent meetings and frank dialogues through shuttle diplomacy," unquote. Trump's tariff hikes on both countries have spurred such cooperation. How Trump's tariffs on Brazil have backfired. Until Trump imposed a 50% tariff on Brazilian imports, the U.S. and Brazil had been talking about a role for American technology and investments in mining Brazil's huge deposits of rare earth minerals. Brazil is believed to hold between 19 and 23% of global reserves of rare earths, a group of 17 elements needed to make powerful magnets used in a range of products, from electric cars and wind turbines to missiles and fighter jets. Unlocking these reserves would be a major step for U.S. manufacturers in reducing dependence on China, which is home to 40% of rare earth deposits and controls around 90% of world supplies. But the tariffs have changed everything.
Brazil is still a far cry from challenging China's processing of rare earth magnets. That will require major investments in mining and manufacturing. During the Biden years, talks had looked positive for U.S. investments in mining rare earths. But now, Brazil is open to talking with the Trump administration, but Trump has called Brazil a horrible trading partner. Not really because of trade, but because the Lula government won't bend to Trump's demand for the release of the right-wing coup conspirator, former President Jair Bolsonaro. Brazil is therefore looking elsewhere for trade partners, to Australia and India, among others. Canada drops many tariffs on U.S. products. In contrast with Brazil and India, Canada-U.S. trade relations have improved somewhat as both countries dropped tariffs in a move to jumpstart trade talks. Canada decided to remove many tariffs on U.S. goods, though both countries will retain what are essentially retaliatory tariffs on each other's steel, aluminum, copper, and vehicles. Canada's Prime Minister Mark Carney now says that the U.S. tariff rate on his country, 5.6% on average, is the lowest of that facing any country. Yet unlike the European Union and Japan, Canada still doesn't have a trade agreement with the United States. The gifts that weren't from the European Union and Japan. 17 days ago, President Donald Trump made a dramatic claim in an interview on the business news channel CNBC. As part of the July trade agreement with the European Union, he said, the EU gave the United States a $600 billion present he could spend however he wanted. Trump insisted that there were no conditions to this gift, that it wasn't an investment promise or a loan, but a gift that he could do with as he wished. Utter nonsense, as the US-EU framework trade agreement text that was just released makes clear. It says that, quote, European companies are expected to invest an additional $600 billion across strategic sectors in the U.S. through 2028, unquote. Thus, the $600 billion not only isn't a gift, it is at best a promise to invest that may or may not be fulfilled. Trump has made the same false reporting with respect to the trade agreement with Japan. Once again, he claimed that, quote, I got a signing bonus from Japan of $550 billion. That's our money. It's our money to invest as we like, unquote. But Japanese officials have described the promised money differently. Its chief trade negotiator has said, quote, it's not that $550 billion in cash will be sent to the U.S., unquote. Instead, the $550 billion will be loans and loan guarantees, with only a fraction of the amount in investments in the United States. Finally, the evisceration of U.S. national security expertise continues. When it comes to purges, the Trump administration is right up there with the Chinese, the Russians, and other authoritarian governments. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth has led the way, having now fired or forced the resignation of the most senior military officials, starting with the Joint Chiefs Chairman and most recently the Air Force Chief of Staff. And Hegseth has just added the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency. That general angered Trump by deciding that the U.S. bombing of Iran did not obliterate its nuclear weapons potential. Other firings include the head of the National Security Agency and his deputy, and the acting chair of the National Intelligence Council and his deputy. Thousands of State Department personnel, many experts in their field, have also been forced out. Hegseth isn't alone. This week, Tulsi Gabbard, the Director of National Intelligence, revoked security clearances for 37 current and former intelligence officials, a move that critics say was politically motivated. In order to, as she put it, root out deep state actors, she announced that she would cut her own office in half. It coordinates the work of more than a dozen agencies and organizations in America's intelligence community. The predictable results of these purges are, first, that policymaking and policy guidance are in the hands of fewer, less capable people, and second, that loyalty to Trump prevails over expertise. Two former intelligence officials write in the magazine Foreign Affairs that, quote, the way the Trump administration is managing the U.S. intelligence system increases the likelihood of an intelligence failure. And that's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening and take good care.
Cable News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
So my name is Lyric Aquino. I'm originally from Cleveland, Ohio. I come from the Pueblo of Okeawenge with Jicarilla Apache lineage and Isleta Pueblo lineage as well. I've been with Underscore for about 2 months now. I have 4 stories out. Go read them. Super excited. And I'm also a Report for America Corps member. I have a bachelor's degree in journalism and anthropology, and I have a master's degree from NYU in science, health, and environmental reporting. I'm also a huge nerd, and I'm very proud of that. And that's a little bit about me.
Thanks so much for being with me here today.
Yeah, thanks for having us, Hannah.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's start off with some of your stories, Lyric. The first one I want to talk about is Oregon nonprofits team up to host their first Indigenous camping trip on Mount Hood. Hoping to break down financial barriers for Indigenous campers, organizers launch a free 3-day culturally immersive camping program focusing on culture, nature, and community building. So can you tell me a little bit about this?
Yeah, so it was a really cool program put on by Parrot Creek Children and Family Services and BARC, which is a nonprofit watchdog organization that monitors logging on Mount Hood. And so they really wanted to break down financial barriers that were in place for a lot of Indigenous people to come camp. And so when we're looking at camping, you know, a lot of us think that it's a super fun activity that we like to do on the weekends, but we don't really get to address those financial barriers. And so oftentimes, you know, camping gear can be expensive. You also have to be able to buy enough food to last you for the weekend and or for the duration of how long you're camping. And, you know, that can provide some access challenges. Also, Mount Hood is 2 hours away from Portland. And so, you know, that's quite a far distance when we're thinking of gas. And we also have to look at when you have your camping gear, even though it can fold down, a lot of times it is bulky. So there are people, you know, like myself currently, who don't have places to store that camping gear where I'm currently living. And so oftentimes there are just all of these facets that are coming together, and it prevents people from being able to go back to Mount Hood, which is sacred to so many local tribes in our area. So together, the nonprofits provided meals. They provided an itinerary and camping gear and also gift cards for gas to really eliminate those barriers so people could come up and have a fun weekend and also really enjoy culturally relevant programming and really get to enjoy the space for, you know, which was for a lot of them ancestrally relevant.
Yeah, that's really sweet. Was there anything in particular during the weekend that like stood out?
Yeah, so one thing that I found to be very fun was how everyone just came together and mingled right away, and the relationships formed very quickly, and it was so great to see everyone be excited to push each other in floaties in Timothy Lake and, you know, dive together off the dock. And I think it was so enriching to see how quickly those relationships formed when you're not under pressure and when you can just really have a space that's welcoming and freeing to be yourself.
Is there any moments or just like things that were specifically like impactful, like people's mm-hmm. experiences that you wanted to share?
Yeah, I think there were a couple things that were really impactful. One of them being that, you know, with federal budget cuts looming, we've seen them, you know, all throughout Indian country. But one thing that we are seeing them affect also is our national parks. And while Mount Hood is not a national park, it's still a beautiful area of land that really needs to be protected. And so when I was talking with some of the campers, they were, you know, discussing amongst themselves that while we're seeing these budget cuts, it's really disheartening to see that more logging could open up on these properties, and then it could further diminish ancestral lands and or spaces that are sacred and culturally relevant to so many tribes and people. Mm-hmm. But I will say that, you know, throughout those discussions, people were discussing ways that they could combat that, you know, different petitions they could start and different ways that they can support each other. So I think in the midst of these cuts, people are banding together to see what they can do. And it's just another facet of Indigenous resiliency.
Nice. Thanks so much for sharing with that story. The next one I want to talk to you about is your story about fishing on the Coquille River. Coquille Indian Tribe-led partnership could bring back Chinook salmon fishing Coquille River this fall. Oregon officials said that the Chinook salmon population would be restored in 10 years. With Coquille leadership, they did it in 3. It's an incredible story. 3 years versus 10. There's been a fishing ban for 4 years. So can you tell me about what spurred this fishing ban and how the Chinook salmon population is recovering?
Yeah, so first off, I just want to say thank you for saying that. It's an amazing story. I was so excited to work on this piece with Jarrett. We actually went down to Coos Bay, and it was so amazing to really hear about the impacts that this had. So the salmon population started dwindling in 2018 when it was revealed from the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife that an invasive species, smallmouth bass, had been introduced into the river, and that was in about 2010. So the population dropped from 11,000 to 900. Then it subsequently dropped to 600 fish. So that's why the ban, you know, was effective immediately. It was not sustainable, and they were looking at possible extinction. Wow. And so it was really, really terrifying for the tribe that not only relies on this for subsistence, but for cultural practices as well. And I mean, in southern rural Oregon, it's, you know, the culture is intertwined with natural resources. And so, you know, we were looking at economic issues as well. So I am really excited to have been able to report on this piece.
Yeah, absolutely. How did you two collaborate on it?
Yeah, so we both drove down and We interviewed John Ogan, and Jarrett took some really awesome photos while we were down there for another story. And we are actually headed back next month to follow some families who fish frequently and are fishing families. And we're hoping to really get the impact of, you know, what this project means to them, and then also share their stories and why this is, you know, culturally relevant and so excited. Mm-hmm. A lot of families did mention that they're excited to have, you know, salmon from their river to offer for ceremony. And so we're really excited to see it.
Yeah, that's amazing. Could you talk to me a little bit more about, like, the community's response with this all?
Yeah. So when we were talking with John, he had said that it really was a entire community project. And so when we were looking at the story originally, it seemed like it was just between the Coquille Indian tribe and the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. But when we started reporting, we found out that the Coquille tribe caught so many fish, exceeding the 75 pairs that the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife were able to take out and spawn, that they asked community members if they were able to house some of these eggs with these low-tech kind of incubator-esque creations that are made with PVC pipe and some wood that just, like, allows water to stream over them. And so there were host families in the community, and they were like, yeah, we want to fish too. So that was super cool. And then also there was support from local businesses and local government officials who were writing letters to the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife and also the governor, you know, stating that this partnership is something that needs to happen because we rely on this fish for our economy, and the best way to do this is traditional ecological knowledge and following the leadership of the tribe. Mm.
Yeah, well said. I'm curious also about how they had this projection of 10 years. Or Oregon officials had that projection. Mm-hmm. Do you know, like, why they expected it to take 10 years and how it was able to be so much faster?
Yeah. So the fish come in waves, and originally the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife only had permits to collect the eggs from and then spawn 75 pairs of fish. So with that, they were going to collect the fish, harvest the eggs, then mix sperm, and then, you know, create the little smolt that would then be turned into brood stock, so they were sexually reproductive salmon. So with 75 pairs, that really wasn't producing a lot, but that was all that they had the permits for. And actually, in their first year, when they were supposed to catch 75, they only caught 3 pairs. So the projections were not looking great. The Coquel tribe stepped in and said, we think we have a better way of doing this. We want to design some fishing traps. So they began designing the fishing traps, but before then, before they were implemented, they gave some tips on how to fish. And then the next year, they were able to catch 25 pairs. So still not the 75 pair that was needed. So those were the projections that we were seeing, you know, with that 10-year down the line. And that wasn't even a guarantee that they would be able to fish in 10 years. It was 10 years we can revisit the idea of potentially fishing. And so, you know, the tribe was like, this is not feasible for us. 10 years is insane. And so after they designed their fishing traps, the year that they were implemented, they caught 155 pairs. That was the highest record. And then the next year, they caught over 200 pairs. I believe it was 250 pairs. So when we were seeing this, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife was hesitant because they were like, we only have permits to, you know, do this with 75 pairs of fish. But the Coquel tribe, like many other indigenous tribes and sovereign nations, you know, really don't believe in wasting resources. And so they were like, yeah, no, we're going to do what needs to be done. And so then that's when they had community partners come in and have these little hatchery-esque incubators to host the salmon eggs, because there were so many that came out of the 155 pairs and the 250 pairs. And so they've been repeating this process, and you know, that's why we're able to see it happen in 3 years, because they doubled the intake.
I would just love to add that we would love for people to read our work, and you could visit all of that stuff at _spelledout.news, UNDERSCORE.news. And yeah, follow us on all of the different social media platforms to keep in contact with us. And if you ever have any story ideas, definitely send them our way.
For KBOO Evening News, I'm Hannah Francis.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.